Intro time. Boom.
Right on.
3, 2, 1, go. Welcome to the Digital Cash Therapy Session. I mean, the Digital Cash Rundown. Happy Friday, everyone. I'm joined by the one and only awesome master of many quotable sayings and technical wizard, Chuck Williams. How's it going, man?
Hey, thanks for the invite, man. I'm really glad to be here. It's an interesting time that we live in, and both in my life and in the world. And man, I'm excited to dive into anything.
Yeah, likewise. This is some cool stuff going on. A lot of crazy things. Just to remind everyone, you can throw me super chats on YouTube as well as Odyssey. The dirty fiat ones that end up in crypto on my end, but whatever. And then if you have one of my NFTs, comment in the Digital Cash Rundown channel. I know one of my people who has an NFT was making jokes about real estate of the mind and stuff like that earlier today when I announced the show. So feel free to chime in there. Any other live chat stuff, you know, I'll look at it. I might not put up on the screen, but all of the above. So yeah, just a reminder, and let me hit this first story here. Ledger. So a letter from Ledger chairman and CEO Pascal Gauthier regarding Ledger Connect exploit, which I did not read the letter. But basically, things to know. December 14th, Ledger experienced an exploit on Ledger Connect Kit, a JavaScript library to connect websites to wallets. The industry collaborated with Ledger to neutralize the exploit, try to freeze stolen funds very quickly. The exploit was effectively running for less than 2 hours. The exploit is currently being investigated. Ledger has filed complaints and will help affected individuals try to recover funds. This exploit did not and does not affect the integrity of Ledger hardware or Ledger Live. The exploit was limited to third-party dApps, which use the Ledger Connect Kit. Sound off, King. What do you think?
Yeah, man. Okay, so first off, I think it's important for everybody, whether you're crypto savvy or not, you need to know that all of your data can be exploited in some way. Now, this wasn't a data hack in this way, but this is an example of one way that the hackers operate. And what does it say? This exploit was the result of a former employee falling victim to a phishing attack. Phishing attack! Phishing attack! Like, they clicked an email or they went to a bad website. They could have gone to, you know, a corn thing, and I'm using corn. Words sensitive to, yeah.
Well, in crypto, corns means something else, but yeah, sure. Seeking one kind of free corn, whether it's Bitcoin or sure. Something else.
Right. And whatever it is, they found themselves, well, they may not even discover it. Like, you click a thing and it's oftentimes it does nothing. Maybe it pops up something in the background. You know, you don't see it. And then it just, you know, now your system is accessible to hackers, you know, and it's often that simple. So there's like these basic practices that I would say most of the internet users of the world are not aware of. And developers and even technical crypto savvy people are subject to this. There's so many different ways that you can be suckered into just clicking a link and continuing the process of engaging with a piece of software in such a way that it does gain access to your system. It's just high risk. And so there's certain things that you just don't do. And oftentimes you don't know that you've been subject to a phishing attack. I worked at Oppenheimer Funds, and they used to do regular tests to see if you would fall victim to these things. And they would do things like around Halloween time, so there would be something that came to the all employees email thread from somebody, and it looked like just noise. And it could have been something attractive, like, hey, look at my Twitter profile with all of my latest Halloween costumes. And it could appear to be harmless and friendly. And as soon as you click it, okay, now you've granted access and you've been flagged as a potential phishing victim and da 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 da. You fail. You know, they would do these silent tests and you would fail, and they would use that as employment on your employment record to decide whether you're going to be hired or continued employment or laid off. But my point is, like, most people still suck at this, and phishing is probably one of the easiest ways. There's so many ways, and my point is we're still Wild West with the internet. Nobody's really safe. Nothing is really safe. Your computer connected is not safe, and you just kind of have to, I think, operate from that space. You should never assume that you're safe. And I think that's difficult for a lot of people who grow up in our society, where they have lived safe lives most of their lives, and then they get on the internet and they don't realize how unsafe it is. And their parents didn't teach them that there is a certain lack of safety. And you end up getting exploited. And you can be doing the best that you can, just only be doing good things, and all of a sudden you are you're the weak link in a holy Swiss cheese chain of employees that are, there's many holes. If it wasn't you, it's going to be somebody else. And if somebody really wants to target an organization, all they have to do, it's just a matter of time, really.
Yeah.
It's just a matter of time. So you kind of have to operate that way. And so, like with Ledger and Trezor and all these people, yeah, it's good to pay attention to these hacks and things like that. But this was not a full breach. You know, the Ledger, according to this, the Ledger hardware wallet portion of it, it's still operational. Your keys are still safe.
And their app, too.
And their app. It's just this dApp that was infiltrated, essentially, with some malicious code. And, you know, that's like, I don't know. I'm trying to think of, like, a decent real-world comparison. Like, I've heard of these stories. The thing that I think of is, like, have you ever heard of these stories where, like, somebody has, like, a bum hiding out in their cellar, you know? Or, like, there's people living in your home. You have such a big home. Like, there's somebody living in a section of your home that you don't even know. Like, they built a secret wall and all this stuff. Like,
this is the only way millennials can afford housing.
yeah, something like that. But this is the equivalent kind of thing. Like, somebody, like, if you weren't using the west wing of your home, theoretically somebody could go live there and you wouldn't know it for a period of time and do malicious things, like use your heat and water and things like that. It's exactly that, happened, you know. Yeah. And Ledger is a big organization with a lot of nooks and crannies to cover, you know. It's just, you're not going to keep all the crickets and rats out.
Yeah. And I did see it's always Maxie's saying stuff, but I saw some Maxie's talking about, like, this is what happens because everything's complicated with the shitcoin casino and all this kind of stuff. And listen, no, but there is the whole, like, I do have a feeling that a lot of, like, the ETH-based space kind of grew up in a cobbled together patchwork kind of way, where it's like, oh, use this. Oh, you can't do that. Well, then connect your wallet. Oh, you can't do that with no hardware support. We'll connect this through this little plugin here and there. And like the number, I mean, obviously things get complicated when you don't just do send and receive. It's just like, all right, you got, like, a wallet and a node, and that broadcast transactions on the blockchain, and their node picks it up, and there you go, that's it. But then you get, okay, well, now you need, like, I feel like there's 8 different, like, SDKs involved in between, like, your private keys and the thing you want to do. And, you know, like, they'll remember the whole,
you mean, like, on the ETH system?
Yes.
With the NFTs and the dApps and all that? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because, so many libraries. Yeah.
Because, first of all, you have, like, the device, the Ledger hardware device. And then you have the first party, let's just say, but the app, Ledger Live, on top of that. And then you have the smart contract that you have to interact with on, like, the Uniswap or whatever website. And then you have that's not enough, because you need that little like Ledger Connect fucking toolkit thing just plugged in there. And then they just, like, got into there because someone clicked a link, because that's what links are for, right? boom. And then just all of a sudden that little thing just makes it so that, oh, wait, we're not connecting to Uniswap. We're, you know, just emptying your wallet. Yay.
Right.
It is like something needs to change. That's not just a, oh, well, this exploit. I do think there should down the road be a lot of like, there's too many trusted like little intermediary slices in every experience here. There's got to be a way to start simplifying some of these things, you know?
Yeah, well, you know, as you're talking, you're reminding me that there was another similar issue with the NPM node package management system, I want to say about a year and a half, maybe 2 years back, where I forgot the name of the library, but it was like this really tiny, thin slice library that like did some string manipulation. Mm-hmm. And the developer who owned it like felt abused or something for some reason and kind of put up his middle finger against using it. And they pulled the library. They killed the library. And that library was a dependency for other libraries. And those libraries were dependencies for other libraries. And when he pulled that library, suddenly nobody who was dependent on that library, which was buried, nested 8 levels down inside of other libraries that people were using, very popular ones, just died. Like, so developers around the world were just halted all of a sudden from working on their code because of this one developer who pulled the plug on and what was up until that point an open source library.
I think hope he they found made out where he lived or something. No,
not I think there were a lot of threats. Yeah. Like if you look it up, like my impression of the whole situation was like there was at least two camps. One camp was like, yeah, that's his right. As a developer, he can put it up or take it down, and he has no obligation whatsoever to keep it up there.
Which is true.
And then the rest of the world, yeah, which is true. And then the rest of the world was like, yeah, but this is an open source piece upon which millions of people depend through tens of thousands of development companies and possibly hundreds of thousands of developers and maybe millions of pieces of lines of code and software and all this stuff, dependencies, right? So they're implicitly trusting this one guy that he's not going to pull the plug, right? And that's actually the case with a lot of public open source code. This almost comes back to this safety issue. You know, nothing on the internet is safe, and that's part of it. We can trust things as long as they work, but as soon as they stop working, you know, it's almost a waste of time to go pointing fingers and playing the blame game, because we're all playing by the same rules, and nobody's guaranteeing safety. If you think you're safe on the internet or even in this world, like, it's mildly delusional, in my opinion. And I think there's just so many people who don't operate from that space. They get wrongfully upset when things go wrong, because they're just operating from this frame of expectation that I think is just fundamentally flawed. Like, you can expect the sun to come up every day, but if it doesn't, like, you know, either it's cloudy or it's destroyed or something else is going on. Like, that, even that's not a guarantee, you know? You don't have the right for the sun to come up. There's nobody to blame if it doesn't come up. That's the reality that we live in. For whatever reason, it didn't come up that day. You know, like, we got to deal with it. And you got to move on as quickly as possible. And if you're going to dwell and look for the blame game, yeah, there's something to learn probably if you have any locus of control. But most of us don't, actually, with these situations.
Yeah.
You just got to move on.
Yeah, absolutely. It is good to have, like, I'm sure in the case of this one developer who pulled their thing, if it was the NPM situation, I'm sure it had already been cloned somewhere else. Like, you know, someone else already had the
there were many other options for this, like, whatever the string manipulation was.
So at least everyone should hopefully be able to just like a lot of fixing fix their code to now point to this repo instead. And you know, hopefully, yeah, that's a good thing about open source stuff. And I don't think Ledger Connect is, I don't know, I'm guessing it's not open source. So that's a problem. And the thing is, I think we're getting to an era of like radical open source development where everything is going to be open source in the future at some point. And the problem with that, well, not everything, but like a lot of things. And the problem with that historically has been the profitability kind of thing. Like, how do you open source something if some competitor can just clone it and, you know, do it like whatever. And I do know a lot of, so for example, with like one thing that I think Thorchain did was brilliant, that the Maya protocol does as well, is they have included in the swap format, the op return or memo data that you do when you do a swap, they have a place for an affiliate fee. So then if you run a front end, you can take a little cut of whatever. And so, for example, like Asgard Dex is a Thorchain and Maya open source, fully open source front end. They do still take a small extra commission on that, which, of course, that means you could just fork their stuff and just not have the fee, and you literally run the exact same stuff as they do, you know, without the fee. But just like, who's going to do that? And you can, but like, because they're like because they're doing well and they're like a trusted piece of software and the fee is low enough, you're okay with doing that. And so even though it's all open source, it's like, as long as the fee isn't outrageous, people are going to do that. And so maybe, you know, let's just say Windows, I don't know if Windows is a good example, but let's just say some gross closed source piece of software comes out and then has some sort of built in monetization. Sure, you could clone it and just like, but it removes the copy it and then just, you know, remove the fee kind of deal. It's, you can, but like, I think that what it does at the end of the day in a lot of these cases is it encourages developers to really build on their product and their niche. And it's kind of interesting as an extra little tidbit on this before we move on, maybe, Chad Bereford, the Thorchain, I guess, lead developer, like one of the big cheese of Thorchain, he's working on some side project as well called Arkio, which is trying to decentralize front ends, basically make a front end like a smart contract where you can just deploy it and it just runs in perpetuity as long as people are willing to pay the gas fees and stuff, right? So it's, so you don't have to have a Uniswap.com or whatever that can be shut down by governments or whatever. It's just like,
oh yeah,
the front end itself is just as decentralized as the smart contract behind it. And
I think that, yeah, federated UIs.
Yeah. And so that kind of stuff is really cool in that it doesn't allow it's not just that censorship resistance, man, you know, keep it, but also it just makes, like, there's no one to call to say, shut it down. Right. And that just makes developers I don't have to deal with a phone call. Just, I write the code, put it out there. People can use it or not. That's it. I don't have to. And so that will be attractive because there's a lot of extra, like, you don't have to have a legal department now, really. You don't have to have this. Right. You don't have to have any of this stuff. So developers could then start to build a lot more stuff strictly open source if they can profit off of it. And then, but that's like a requirement of being able to opt out of the centralized headaches that come around that. And so, but then you have to do it open source. So then there's the risk of, well, you have to make sure you're ahead so that no one's going to be like, I'm going to fork this and then just tweak a bit and I'm going to take all your money. You've got to stay ahead enough to where that's not going to really happen to you. So it's harder to win. But then it's also, if you just remain closed source, you're in this, like, you have a whole nother set of problems, the legacy problems to deal with. So that'll be interesting to see how, like, the free market and innovation solves, or I shouldn't say solve because nothing gets solved, but like addresses all these issues.
Yeah. Well, so this is, I mean, I could talk forever about this, this particular topic, because as a software developer for coming up on 25 years now, this is always a choice that you make perhaps multiple times along the way. You know, like, I'm literally involved in several projects where we're at the beginning of phases of writing code and we're making decisions, proprietary or open source, and build or buy. And, you know, in each of those, there are degrees, honestly, like that's where we're at right now. There's a full spectrum of fully closed source, 100% proprietary, but now you, there's benefits. The pros are generally you get to make all the money, but the cons are you're generally responsible for everything that happens inside of that software. You're alone.
No one's helping you out. No one's looking at your code. No random nerd breaking your shit and then telling you this sucks. And then, oh, thanks. That was a billion-dollar thing for free.
But you get all the money, all the rights, all the control. Mm-hmm. But also, the government is going to hold you responsible for everything that that application does.
You're going to have a counterterrorism office like Facebook does.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. That's and you're going to have to field police requests and all that kind of stuff, depending on how far reaching your thing is. But that's your responsibility. That's you just automatically take that on when you go proprietary, you own it. And then on the other side end of the spectrum, you know, fully open source generally means you're not going to make any money. There's no way to make money on that. And so what you have to do is you have to get your software out there. That the strategy tends to be you use open source to get it out there and to harden it and get interested people, and you build communities around the open source project, and then that enables like an ecosystem to be built on top of the foundational open source thing. I mean, that's Bitcoin right there. You have Bitcoin that is open source, and there's I don't know, tens of thousands of businesses built on top of Bitcoin now.
Well,
each of those a proprietary corporation.
This is an excellent segue because we have two Bitcoin-related stories. So first, ShakePay, which ShakePay used to provide like a crypto debit card. I had one. It was a Dash debit card as well. But then they went to be a weird Bitcoin maxi-only on-ramp thing. And, you know, screw you, ShakePay. Anyway, so they said, we had a data incident. Here's what you need to know. And it says, we want to emphasize that only data was compromised. No bank accounts, crypto wallets, etc. What happened? And then it says, blah, blah, blah. We suspect that the following personal information may have been part of the breach. Name, email address, date of birth, phone number. Name, email, address. Not email address, email.
Right.
Address, home address. Home address. Date of birth, phone number, occupation, trusted contact, account balances, and transaction activity. So if you were a dumb freaking maxi and you were buying from ShakePay, you got wrecked. You got so wrecked. I'm not saying this isn't good. This is not good. I'm not cheering
okay,
for this.
Okay, hold
this
on.
Sucks.
I got to check you on this because I'm sure you remember the Experian hack, right?
I think so. There's been a lot of them. I don't remember which
okay,
one.
Okay, so, I mean, I'm just trying to have sympathy for people who use ShakePay because they bill themselves as the Canadian way to buy Bitcoin. And
yes,
Bitcoin,
I have tons of sympathy for those people. I'm just saying.
But the thing is, like, I mean, they're doing what they think is the right thing to do. They're not, I mean, you're never going to, I mean, never. Most people don't go to a website and assume that they're just lying to them outright, you know?
Like, and the website was not lying to them.
You know? Exactly.
Shit happens, right?
Right, exactly. And it's hard to be upfront with this. It's like, so, but I'm saying like the Experian hack, what was it? If you had any credit information at all in America as an American, your information's out there. The same information. Like they got hacked. Mm-hmm. Everything got out there. Your address, your credit score, your social security number, all that. It's out there. It's out there. It's already out there. If you've had credit in the past 10 years, it's out there. And it's
so
already being stolen.
Mine is not, but everyone else maybe.
Right. Right. Well, yeah.
And, most people.
Crypto people like you. Most people, if you have any credit interaction whatsoever, your information is out there for sale and you're a target for a hack, especially if you have a decent credit score. And my point is, nobody opted in to Experian except when they did, because they didn't know that. They didn't know that they were doing that when they got their first credit card or when they made their first payment on a on a car note or whatever. You know, that's how it happens. And they didn't opt into that, but I think there may even been a class action suit, but maybe they were protected. I can't remember how it played out, but ultimately Experian got a slap on the hand and everybody got wrecked in the same way that ShakePay wrecked. What did they didn't say all, some of their customers, didn't they? Isn't that what it was?
I think it could be all of them. The thing is, they're not fully disclosed.
They said a very small number of our customers.
Yeah, well, we'll see. I mean, it could be it could be that they only have like 4,000 customers and like 3,800 of them got hacked. That's just not a big number compared to Binance's customers. Yeah. It's very small. Like, again, we're trusting things. The thing is, for a long time, it was like Bitcoin was old and steady. You know, people use Bitcoin. People in the weird alt world were just getting wrecked right and left by things like this. And Bitcoin, you know, whatever. Now I think the tide is starting to turn where all this weirdness of the DeFi world and stuff is being worked through well enough that these hacks are, you know, there's less and less, you know, severity to these kinds of exploits, things like that. But then the Bitcoin world, especially the maxi world, is still on, it's still on Web2, right? It's still running. They're still in the legacy systems. There's like a crypto bank that just lost everyone's customer info. Now, the thing is, if you interact with, say, Uniswap, it's not going to leak your date of birth and stuff because it doesn't have it, right? Just the way it is.
Right.
And so
I say, let's avoid KYC, people. Yes. If you can, this is how we send the message. The solution here, stop using anything that requires KYC. If you can avoid it at all, find something else that doesn't force you to use KYC. I make exceptions to this rule, so I'm just going to call that out too. I could be a bit of a hypocrite by making this recommendation, but I'm consciously doing it. So look for non-KYC alternatives.
Absolutely, and everything in fully self-custodial things, because the problem with, so if I buy, let's say a dollar cost, let's just say I have a grand in discretionary income a month. Let's just throw a random number out there, right? Like a grand after all the essential bills, it's just my fun money. What if I put 500, or not even a 500, but 200 a month, I buy crypto every single month. Let's say I don't, but people, let's say regular people. And then they want to just withdraw it immediately, right? Like let's say they get $100 every 2 weeks, they buy crypto with it. They withdraw it immediately. Their counterparty risk is like, you know, their custodial risk is low. But then if you withdraw $100 and then you pay $20, $15 in Bitcoin transaction fees, you might wait to withdraw till the next time. Or maybe every quarter now you start. And then you have this custodial risk building up. And the same thing goes when, you know, you don't want to get just like paid in Bitcoin and then send some to pay your bills through Spritz Finance, for example. Send some over here, send there, because then you're just like, just get stabbed with all these fees. So you'd rather just be like, you know, I'm going to get paid in fiat. I'm going to pay all my fiat bills. And then the rest of it, I'm going to use this custodial service to go buy. And so at that point, now you start to get enclosed back into these fiat custodial systems. You start to need a ShakePay to buy all your stuff. You don't get to just get paid and then, oh, sorry. Then your literal employer would have to get, you know, if you even have a official employer, would have to then get hacked to get all your private information out there. And so it's not like a haha Maxis thing. It's kind of a haha Maxis thing. It will be in 5 to 10 years when they're the only ones getting wrecked and everyone else is everyone else is getting wrecked in new and creative but decentralized ways. You know, let's not be too naive and pretend it's going to be smooth sailing. But
here's the thing. I think the problem here is the KYC. It's the regulatory it's the regulatory requirement that is the problem. And because this information, they wouldn't have to collect it. The only reason they have to collect it is to be legally compliant as custodians. That's it. That's the only reason that they have to. If they didn't have to, it would be a more likely target for those who want to launder money anonymously or move money anonymously.
That's the correction.
I mean, that's the thing is, it's such a small portion. Like those people, it's so much easier to just go to HSBC and launder money, but through the banks that they built for the drug lords to push briefcases through their specialized windows in, you know, what was it, Mexican locations? Like that's a thing. Like the banks are more likely to cater to your laundering activities than, you know, the happenstance of a Bitcoin operation.
Absolutely.
You know, they're not going to try to help you launder money like HSBC did and got fined for. Mm-hmm. And actually, yeah. And other banks.
That's an important point. So the thing about KYC, and it's as long as you have fiat interactions, it's really hard. So people want to, either if they're maxi, they buy Bitcoin and then eventually move to a Trezor. You can't do that every time or you eat fees. If you want to be a buy crypto and then trade on a centralized exchange, it's the same thing. That's where you get hit with all this custodial, like full KYC, what are the source of these funds, all this kind of nonsense. Now, a small, obviously, if you get paid directly in crypto, that's a different story. But there's a kind of in-between bit, which I've noticed, which is there's a lot of these DeFi front ends, like Thor Wallet, which is, I love Thor Wallet. It's great. A little buggy these days, but it, whatever. They have an on-ramp to their Thor Wallet DEX. I forget which provider it is, but in the US, which is one of the worst regulatory environments for on-ramping, you can buy up to $2,000 of crypto a year with no KYC at all. And the reason they're able to do that legally is because they're non-custodial. They never hold your money and then you withdraw. It just goes right into your proof of keys wallet that then is plugged into this DEX so you can go swap for anything you want. The problem is that's shitcoining or whatever. But that paradigm, like, where is there going to be a similar like on-ramp, like no KYC on-ramp that's popular in maxi wallets and ecosystems? It's already possible. You can't just be a Bitcoin maximalist, buy, you know, use Thor Cash, whatever their on-ramp system is, buy no KYC in chunks for like $2,000 a year or whatever it is, or something. It's way higher than that if you're doing through Mount Pelerin, which is Switzerland based, but that's for European people. But if you're a European maxi, you can buy a ton of Bitcoin with no KYC, with like your bank account or credit card, whatever. And then you just don't have that problem at all. But they're just not even in that frame of mind because they're just in dinosaur maxi mode in this like centralized exchange. I got to give my ID and this is how it works. And then they can complain when, you know, Binance gets shut down in yet another country or something. So,
right.
So that's that. Let me hit on this Liquid story. Because this is hilarious to me. Anyway, so Liquid. So I'll start to say, under high fee market, there's been renewed interest in second layers, resulting in increased adoption of Liquid. Many blah, blah, blah. And they did this big debunking thing about Liquid is centralized or whatever. It's like, I have not yet done a deep dive into Liquid. I have heard that it's federated, but who the members of the federation, who decides that, and how do you get included in the federation? From what I've heard people who don't like Liquid say, is just like completely opaque. But again, I'm beginning the disclaimer because I haven't done research into this. But my overarching point with this, so I can let you speak for once, is that Liquid was, so Blockstream controlled Bitcoin development. They hired a lot of Bitcoin developers way back in the day. Bitcoin pivoted towards L2 only, basically, or L2 for small purchases. Blockstream talked about Lightning, they're, you know, investors in Lightning Labs and a bunch of other stuff like that. But they finally put out their own L2, Liquid, many years ago. No one used, everyone mocked it, it just didn't work. And everyone went to try Lightning. And then Lightning, when it starts getting pounded with these high fees, just is not working out super well. So now the long game is coming out. And let me just switch to my little tweet thing. So basically said Bitcoin pivoted from peer-to-peer digital cash after Blockstream hired developers, basically breaks that thing down and just says, like, the rug pull is complete. This is how to capture a decentralized network. They're finally, like, literal Blockstream is now running what is being pushed. And I've seen a lot of maxi influencers switch over the last week. Just all of a sudden, Liquid's on everyone's mind. and the new PSYOP is in place. They're all going to Liquid. Blockstream wins in the end. That's just kind of where we are so far. What do you think?
So I hadn't popped up, or Liquid hadn't popped up on my radar until today. You sent me this article yesterday. Mm-hmm. I think the federated model is interesting. I think it can work. I do have my own like biases against Blockstream. Like, I don't like how they've behaved over the past 8 years or so in a lot of scenarios. I think there's a lot of PSYOP-y kinds of activity that they've been engaged with. I do think that they have an agenda to push Bitcoin itself in a direction that is most profitable for them. And it's at the expense of openness and public debate and you know, what is actually good for the public. You know, I don't think that they're necessarily the guardians of what's good for the future economic sovereignty of individuals, like I believe the ethos of Bitcoin was intended for. I think that Blockstream itself is trying to create a bridge between the future and the industries of today. And I think that is ending up with a certain political milieu that is limiting what they will propose and what they believe can be profitable, and constraining everybody involved with Blockstream from really speaking what's true and what might be publicly damaging, but you know, to their organization, but actually good for, you know, the people, the non-Blockstream people. So Liquid itself, I think, is an interesting technology, interesting layer two technology that I don't know the guts of exactly how it works, but I see the federated approval. I see the one-to-one peg of the LBDC token. You know, they make a very adamant claim that if you want to invest in Liquid, just buy Bitcoin, you know, and you can use the protocol. So, you know, I think in that way, they're aligning with the Bitcoin maxis in that they're making Bitcoin itself their core protocol, right? If Bitcoin fails, Liquid fails, basically, which I think is kind of cool. You know, they're choosing, they're literally hitching to a cart to a certain horse, and it's, you know, a pretty solid horse as horses go in this race. So I have this overall mistrust of how their intent, the agenda that's tied to it. Like, I could see 2-3 years from now, Klaus Schwab shaking hands with Adam Bach and saying, "Hey, yeah, let's do this Liquid conversion of our CDBCs, you know, like, let's do it."
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know. Well, that's exactly it. Is what is it? Jeff Garzik and Gavin Andreessen, I believe, many, many years ago, wrote an article, said Bitcoin's being hotwired for settlement. And that was referenced in Mike Hearn's resolution of the Bitcoin experiment in January of 2016, which I just reread because it's some really good stuff to reread.
Yeah. I remember his, like 7-8 years rant. Later.
Yeah. And as I freely admit, I thought he was kind of full. Like, I dismissed it at the time. I was like, come on, you're being dramatic. It's going to fix itself. And he was 100% right. I mean, it worked out super well. But anyway, Bitcoin, it used to be, well, it's like there's this interesting transition period where Bitcoin as peer-to-peer digital cash, and then Bitcoin as a settlement-only asset, like digital gold. There's those two visions. The digital gold one kind of won out in 2017, but there's been this middle ground of like, well, you can still do on-chain. Lightning is really Bitcoin because it's really two-party multi-sigs all stitched together that are on-chain. Like, it's real Bitcoin, kind of, even though the Lightning part isn't. And like, they've still been on the one foot in each world of like, is it a settlement asset or is it peer-to-peer digital cash? And they kind of like, they've been on the fence, and now with the monkey JPEGs coming through, smashing things. Lightning's just not working because it's too Bitcoin-y. Now Bitcoin is for inscribing big things and moving big financial transactions. Now finally Bitcoin's being pushed fully into what people were complaining about for many years, into a fully settlement asset and like a backing asset. And now I think that's going to, a few maxis are going to leave the fold over that. And then some will go in and be on that side. And now I think it's going to be sort of a race now that, and Liquid has the head start of head starts right now, other than centralized exchanges and stuff. But now I think it's going to be a race. I mean, I'm still focusing on digital cash. I don't give a crap about this stuff, but this is, it's, I think it's a, an industry race to see who can have the best wrapped Bitcoin product that people can trust. Like, because Bitcoin is not, Bitcoin doesn't work as Bitcoin anymore, but it's still there. And it's still, so ETH wrapped Bitcoin is great, except somehow if you want to pay more to transact on Bitcoin than you already were, boo, you know, whatever. But like, what if there's a wrapped Bitcoin on Avalanche? Let's just say wrapped Bitcoin on this, on that. Whatever network has the least amount of trust and the most amount and the least amount of latency and the most amount of security for transacting censorship resistant Bitcoin denominated coins is going to win out huge. So I don't think Bitcoin's going away over the next 5 years. Over 10 years, I think we're definitely going to start seeing other things take it over. But I do think that over that time, there's going to be a scramble for who's going to send Bitcoin the best, because Bitcoin gave up on being sendable. Anyway, couple minute rant. What do you think?
That's an interesting perspective. I like the challenge. I'm just processing what you've said, and it makes me think that, it's an interesting perspective, because first off, my first response is the market has spoken, right? But the challenge that we have with the market is there's the Pareto principle is going to dictate that 80% of people are not going to know what they're talking about. So they're going to have limited information upon which to act and transact. And that's actually going to move things. And that is not necessarily going to be a well-informed movement. I think it's going to be what's going to surface in that environment is what is the most valuable. And I think that's what you're trying to point at. What is the most valuable? And it's, and it, you know, there's that narrative that's existed since Bitcoin came out of what, cash versus gold, wealth versus store of wealth versus transmission of value. You know, that kind of like spectrum of risk, and then what was it, Zuko's triangle, right, with security, and I can't remember what exactly the triangle is, but there's a number of models that have come about to address the forces at play in how to value crypto, and I have a very opinionated, like, personal position that nothing is valuable inherently. It's all,
here we go,
value is belief, right? that's where it is. It's all there must be a conscious individual who is actually going to process that value. And when you get a group of people, that's your market, you know? And we now have multiple markets. Like, the crypto market used to just be one market, but it's not anymore. It's just not. You now have stratified layers of people who are involved in crypto. You got your Bitcoin maxis, you got your Bitcoin open and alternative coins, and you know, the shitcoin people and the DeFi people and the builders, the people who are technically inclined, who just want to build on top of it, and the financiers who just want to make money. And then you got everybody else who just, like, I mean, I don't want to put everybody else in a bucket. There's so many different stratifications in just the crypto space now that each of those groups has their own ways of valuing what is valuable, what can, that which can be valued. Some people want speed. Some people don't care about speed. Some people want data. Some people don't care about data. And it's, those are the forces at play. And, you know, I'm it's, I don't think any individual, like, you have to be a super forecaster. There's literally a book called Super Forecaster. Like, you have to be really, really good at taking in a lot of different perspectives and synthesizing those perspectives in order to predict with any level of calculability, accuracy, what is actually, what the market is actually going to say is valuable. Absolutely. I think it's better just to see, just to observe and learn from what the market is actually saying. And, you know, that's why I try to be open and honest about my biases, especially against like Blockstream and these very influential crypto space organizations, because when Mike Hearn dropped off, I had concluded myself, oh my God, he was CIA operative. I'm telling you, man, I think that he was just straight up CIA, and he rage quit because he had a directive that he had a mission that he could not fulfill. He could not get the influence that he needed, in my opinion. And that's why he gave up. He was like, this isn't going where I was instructed for it to go. Basically, that's what I think. But that's just me, right? I have no basis of that whatsoever other than just observing his the way that he was treating the space and how Blockstream is operating in the space and how they're going sometimes blatantly against what the people are saying they want in the Bitcoin space. And to me, it's like they're in their ivory tower. And why are they just making these decisions? And ultimately, you know, you can just follow the money. That's ultimately what it's about, I think.
Yes.
So the market is going to be influenced and manipulated, and we're going to see more of that. And we're going to see more. That's why we need to make crypto and Bitcoin more accessible to people, and it needs to be embedded in more and more layers. And I honestly think that this is being prevented. I think there's an active effort to prevent especially Americans from getting into the crypto space, because it's like the government and the people who are issuing CDBCs, they want to be the ones to put that first digital token in your wallet. They don't want it to be Bitcoin because that's too free, that's too decentralized, and there's no throat to choke. They want to be able to make sure that you pay your taxes and don't buy too much meat with your digital token.
So listen, I think in about 2 weeks, I'll converse offline, but I think we should have you back on for as part of another show because there's too much stuff for the time constraints for today. There's a lot of really, there's a lot of stuff that I don't want to stop this, but unfortunately we do have to. I got a podcast coming up right now. So, thanks everyone for watching. This has been fantastic. Exactly what I wanted from Chuck. Thanks very much, Chuck. This has been a pleasure to honor, and we will do more of this, of course. Don't forget, taxation is theft. Your phone is spying on you. All value is belief. Live on crypto before it's too late, and enjoy the weekend, you animals. Bye-bye.
Thanks, everybody.